If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, August 5th. My name is Alice Wu, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ginyangahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Today, we'll be tuning into a panel by the BC Civil Liberties Association. It features organizers and lawyers from across Canada as they discuss the policing of Black and Indigenous individuals. We'll hear what the situation is like now and some strategies for enacting change.
Hi, welcome everybody. Thanks for joining us today on our panel, Policing Black and Indigenous Lives in Canada. I'm Latoya Farrell with the BC Civil Liberties Association, and I am streaming to you from the traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations in so-called Vancouver. I was born in Fort McMurray on Treaty 8 territory, and I'm really happy to be here with all of you today. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the BC Civil Liberties Association. It's the oldest and most active civil liberties and human rights group in Canada. We're a nonpartisan charitable society striving to promote, defend, sustain, and extend civil liberties and human rights in British Columbia and Canada. We achieve this through our mandate and through our litigation, our law reform, community-based legal advocacy work, public engagement, and education. And just a little bit about our work on policing. We've had a long-standing history of pushing for police accountability and advocating for police reform. Some of that work includes advocating for a provincial ban on the illegal and discriminatory practice of police street checks, hashtag ban street checks now. If you'd like to go to our website, you can sign the petition. We've also been working in collaboration with the Union of BC Indian Chiefs and the Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chiefs and Land Defenders to hold the RCMP accountable for their improper and unlawful actions in enforcing the arbitrary exclusion zone in Wet'suwet'en territory. So you can always find out more about our work at bccla.org, and we welcome you to explore some of the amazing things that my colleagues are doing right now. So for those of you who are just joining us, welcome again. This event is being recorded, so folks will be able to watch it later at youtube.com/user/BC Civil Liberties. We would love to hear from you and invite you all to comment and ask questions in the YouTube comment section. This is a space where people are invited to engage in discourse, and I urge everyone to respect both the panelists and each other when having these conversations. So thank you for participating. So I just want to tell you a little bit about the event before introducing our amazing panel. So today our panelists, Elle Jones, Dr. Pamela Palmater, Rakesh Walters, and Meenakshi Mano will be exploring issues in policing, like expanding the role of police in expanding the colonial state, evidence of police violence and discrimination, and current strategies for transformative change, and how folks like you watching can get involved, and we'd love for you all to get involved. So I just want to I just want to introduce our first panelist today. So Elle Jones is a recipient of the Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission Burnley Rocky Jones Award and co-founder of the Black Power Hour, a radio show developed with prisoners. Welcome today, Elle, and we're really pleased to have you, and I'm excited to hear everything that you have to say.
Thank you. One never wants to go first, but here we are. I'm speaking to you from Jibuktuk, Halifax, in the unceded, unsurrendered territories of the Mi'kmaq people, Mi'kma'ki, governed by the Peace and Friendship Treaties of 1752. And I also want us to remember that at the same time, obviously, as the Mi'kmaq were signing treaties with the Crown, Black people were also under enslavement by that Crown. So welcome, everybody. I want to go through a couple of things today. I think the first thing I really want to talk about is a story that I just spent the last week working on that I think is really important to understanding how policing is so ingrained into our society. So one of the problems, and I said this with street checks, I'm going to talk about this later, some of the lessons from fighting street checks here that perhaps also people in BC might want to follow up, which is often when we're fighting, say, depression, we sort of hyper-focus on this one thing like street checks or defunding police. And when we don't pay attention to the ways that these things take place all throughout the state, we often find ourselves having exhausted our energy on one battle only to find, of course, the ground has shifted and that the violence is taking place in all these other places as it always has. So when we talk about policing, it's really important that we maintain the idea that policing is not just officers in uniforms on the street. That is one form of policing. But policing is, of course, found through the immigration system, in the borders. Policing is, of course, also found through the education system, where we see the criminalization of young Black children, in the healthcare system, and of course, in things like the so-called care system, the social workers as well. And so a story I just worked on that I want to talk a bit about is about Fatuma and Abdul Abdi. And this is a battle that many people in BC civil liberties were part of. And if people remember this in 2018, Abdul Abdi, when we were fighting this battle, we were focused on Abdul, who came as a refugee to Nova Scotia. The children, him and his sister, were very quickly taken into care and made permanent wards of the state. They were bounced around to a number of homes. And when Abdul turned 19, he was convicted of assault. And because he had not received his citizenship, because the province did not do so, they were negligent, he was eligible for deportation. Because of course, under the laws, changed under Kenny and Harper, but it was always any time over 2 years you can be deported, and then it got reduced to 6 months that don't even have to be served concurrently. So Abdul was threatened with deportation, and his sister Fatuma began fighting this battle. And at the time when we were fighting in 2018, one of the things that we saw is that Black Canada responded in a particular way. And the reason for that was because that case so clearly illustrated the ways that anti-Blackness operates in all facets in Canada. So not just in the criminal justice system or the policing system, but also in the education system where Abdul only received a grade 6 education. Obviously in the immigration system that intersects with the criminal justice system, the youth justice system, and in the child welfare system as well. So people understood that all of these pieces were working together to bring Abdul to a point where Canada was saying, we want you out of the country. But the story I was writing this week was about his sister Fatuma, because now both Abdul and Fatuma are suing the province as well as some of the homes they were in and the CAS, like the Child Advocacy Service, for neglecting them, not taking their culture into account and subjecting them to tremendous and horrible harms that are detailed in the lawsuit. Abuse on just such an atrocious level, I don't really want to get into the details. And the thing I really wanted to focus on here is, again, this reminder that this is all policing. So in Fatuma's story, where she talks about being a young Black girl, she talks not only, of course, about being removed from her own family and placed into care, but then all the ways that, for example, her body is policed as a young Black girl. So when she's reporting abuse and particularly reporting sexual assault and rape, when she's 11 and 12 years old and living in group homes and saying, these men are coming around me, they're harassing me, they're stalking me. At one point, she's trafficked to Montreal as like a 12 or 13 year old. And all of this is hypersexualized because she's a young Black girl and it's treated as though she is promiscuous. And this is written in her file that she's promiscuous. So when she's reporting rapes, they're telling her that she's lying, she has attention seeking behaviors. And this is of course directly connected to the ways that Black women from enslavement have always been hypersexualized and deemed as rapeable. So part of enslavement for women, not only the theft of labor, but of course also the theft of reproduction and the theft of sexuality. That is part of the whole process of colonization racism upon Black women. And so what we see is, of course, industrial style rape upon Black women, and then of course the theft and removal of Black children that exists into the present day. And of course, Indigenous people have a very similar experience, right? Our experiences aren't the same, but we know the same experiences of being taken into the child welfare system, not because of abuse, but simply because of being deemed unfit in particular ways, meaning unfit for colonial society. So Fatuma not only herself experiences the removals, this hypersexualization, being denied and erased over and over again. Every time she tells about abuse, she's told she's lying. She's told she's angry, all of these things. And of course, once she has her own children, we see those files being used to now label her and remove her children from her and take those children to care. So we see the multi-generational way in which this care system does violence upon Black women and their children and families from generation to generation. So that literally before she can even hold her children, they're showing up at the hospital and taking them. A situation very, very familiar to Indigenous mothers with birth alerts, for example, where we see the same thing. And so what I wanted to raise here is that in this time when we're talking about defunding the police, a lot of people have said, yes, we should be sending social workers on these calls. And it's very, very important to remember that social workers are also part of this colonial violence system. It's social workers who neglected and abused Fatuma and Abdul, placed them in inappropriate homes, had no cultural lens, didn't check in on them, told Fatuma she was lying when she was sexually assaulted and raped, put her in ever more secure homes as punishment, which basically incarcerated her, and then were punitive to her children literally just for the act of her reproducing. So when we start talking about we need to replace police with social workers, we need to understand that social workers are police as well. They can come into your home, they can look through your cupboards, they can take your children, they can show up anytime without calling, they can monitor your body, they can decide if you should be injected with birth control, they can decide if you should be injected with psychiatric medication. They have a control over your body and spirit and womb and all of these things that is so deep. I also want to cite the hospital here, because in Fatuma's story, we also see doctors, of course, calling social workers on Fatuma. And so we know this medical staff is also deeply implicated in the violence of the state, something that also happens, of course, to psychiatric patients, for example, or people who are living with mental illnesses, where the healthcare staff and the medical staff are involved in this pathologizing of them and this criminalizing of them. So I think it's really important that we remember that in the history of colonization, and particularly for white women, white women's involvement in colonization was through things like being missionaries, being teachers at residential schools, and then white women abused Indigenous kids in absolutely horrific ways. Being teachers in our colonized nations and, doing violence to Black and brown people around the world and, instilling ideas that we were going to hell and all those things. And that is a violence ingrained in the so-called caring system. And we can't separate that missionary system from the current day child welfare system, which also is the healthcare system as well. So that's the first thing I really wanted to say, is that I really want us to keep in mind the ways that policing must be seen as something holistic in that sense. The state does its violence in all places. The state does not just do its violence in one site. So that also leads me to a second case, since I was talking about the intersection of healthcare and the notion of caring. Abdul always said, don't ever say that we were in care. There was no care involved. We were in the child welfare system and there was no welfare involved, right? So he always made that point that to call a child being taken into care, where is the care in that? And that was something that Abdul always said. And I want to also think about that notion of care, because the police themselves are now designating themselves, for example, frontline workers and integrating themselves with healthcare workers. So we see it going both ways, right? On the one hand, we see the securitization of healthcare, where you have nurses and doctors saying they want to call the police in. They need to do this violence. They need security to do their jobs, and this idea of health becoming policing. And then on the other side, we also see policing claiming to become health, right? So we see officers saying we're first responders. And I'm like, but you're first responders that kill people. You're first responders that show up with guns. And that seems like this small thing that we often don't pay attention to linguistic shifts. So we say, okay, well, like, let's let them call themselves first responders. But it actually matters. When Bill Blair is saying, I spend over 30 years as a first responder, as a frontline worker, I'm like, no, you weren't. You're a cop and you're a police chief. You weren't a frontline worker. So that actually is accomplishing something in terms of how we begin to see the police. During COVID, we begin to talk about the police along with grocery store workers, healthcare workers, and police as though those are the same things. And that's a really, really dangerous slippage, right? That hides the violence that is being done. And then also allows the violence to integrate itself into the way we think. So during COVID, we've seen a really strong example that's not new, but is reemerging, of this way of this intersection of health and policing, right? So I always call this the hygiene argument that goes long time back to colonialism, right? The notion that Indigenous people, Black people, the Native, is unhygienic, right? So a lot of colonialism and the control of that is around the notion that we spread disease. Blackness itself is seen as a contamination. This is why, like, when you hear hip hop, oh my gosh, you go crazy, because Blackness is just contaminating you in these particular ways, right? And we're seeing these arguments be manifested through COVID policing. So in Atlantic Canada, like, every single case where someone's been particularly criminalized with COVID has been the case of a Black person, and particularly African immigrants, and more particularly Congolese immigrants, particularly Francophone African people. So there's just recently a story that came out on CBC where in New Brunswick, they had accused this Black doctor, Congolese doctor, of spreading COVID to the province, being irresponsible because he'd gone to reserve. So you see the intersection of this. Oh, the Indigenous people must have spread it to the Black doctor, who then was irresponsible and spread it to everybody else. And they've just done the tracing, and it doesn't seem that that's true. It seems actually he got COVID in New Brunswick. But of course, it was, of course, the African as the outside immigrant contaminating force that was seen as spreading COVID. And of course, he received death threats. He lost his job. His name was published. That is very tied to this notion of policing Black bodies. In PEI, where I'm headed right after this, we see the case of a young man named Javon, another Congolese person, international student, who picked up his brother in Nova Scotia. His brother had traveled from the States. They did follow quarantine, but the quarantine changed during that time. We had this thing called the Atlantic bubble, and he ended up contracting COVID. And they ended up sending him to a migrant worker facility to quarantine him. So I'm going to just go ahead and guess. I haven't done, you know, the call to ask them, but I'm going to guess that white people with COVID were not sent to the migrant worker facility. So first of all, we can talk about the fact that we need a quarantine space for migrant workers and what that means, when at the same time we're like, get out here and pick our blueberries, get out here and do our agricultural labor. You have no path to citizenship and you don't have healthcare, but we're going to set up this, you know, like, camp for you just in case you contract a disease, but also you've signed a paper that you can't sue our government if you did, right? So we can also just talk about the designation of that space in itself as a particular way. And then sending the student there, obviously under the logic of you're African, they're brown and Black, you belong in that place. So when he couldn't survive there and on the last day said, I'm going to die in here, and went outside, of course the cops were called, and he told the cops, I have COVID, and they took that as a threat, and he is still incarcerated in PEI. He's in up for trial tomorrow, and of course faces deportation, faces the loss of his student visa. So we again see all of these systems firing together. So those are just some current examples that I wanted to catch people up on, and I think they illustrate this moment really well. The last thing I wanted to say, and I know I'm probably talking long and I'm about to get the camera pop up on me, is this is why I think it's really important. I particularly want to talk about the fight against street checks, something that we have been fighting in Nova Scotia and that has supposed to be accomplished, but it is not accomplished. Street checks are not banned. So we went through the process where the data came out on street checks in 2016. And since then, there was obviously a fight in the community. And of course, that fight was much longer. Of course, the data we received was because of the Kirk Johnson case that was like in 2001. The police had been forced to give data as part of the human rights settlement in 2004. They had kept the data and never released it. And then in 2016, the data is released after CBC FOIPOPs it, and we find out the street check data. And since then, of course, the Black community was struggling against street checks, and first to win a moratorium and then to get a ban. I don't mean to spoil the ending, but the ban that they say is not a ban. Street checks continue. And this sort of illustrates some of our problems with activism, because we fought so hard on street checks, but of course, and they narrowly legally defined street checks to mean one thing. And we were never talking about street checks as like this one thing, like a check for information with no criminal charge. We were talking about profiling and brutality and our ongoing relationship to the police. But now they've legalized it and said, well, you want us to ban this one thing, and we did that. And we're like, but we're not talking about that. We were talking about everything. So that's one kind of challenge, that when we focus really narrowly, it allows them to then say, okay, we're not doing that thing, but continue racially profiling us, which of course, they were able to really return to during COVID, where suddenly they can get your health information, they can stop you without ID, they can enter your home. The other thing is, and this is the last thing I say, I see you on the camera, is I have a rant about when did the fight against policing become so neoliberal? And I think that's really a challenge of the moment we're living in. I'm not being a hipster here and being like, I was against policing before y'all were against policing. You know, the point isn't to gatekeep activism. But I think there's a difference between recognizing that everybody can be an activist and has a capability of being an activist and must be an activist, and everything anyone does is activism. Those are two different things, right? So in this moment, what's dangerous is we're often seeing people who are caught up in this kind of moment, sometimes well-intentioned, sometimes for like extremely nefarious purposes by the state. Now policing has become this issue where we have, for example, this Black North initiative that is business leaders that are going to have a justice committee where we have Mark Saunders, the just retired police chief of Toronto, heading up an at-risk youth committee. Like, why? Because you put youth at risk. And this becomes this notion that this is how we're going to fight policing and racism. There's nothing, of course, that they're saying they're going to divest from policing. We're not asking Scotiabank to stop funding oil companies. We're not asking them to stop funding the military or stop selling weapons or to give people Indigenous sovereignty that are all things that would like actually end policing. We're like, oh, these corporations will fund some kind of weird corporate neoliberal initiative. And then this is taken as you guys are doing what Black people want because this is justice and this is policing. So we have to stay political. We have to stay focused on state violence. We can't allow the fight to be narrowed down to, well, you just wanted to defund. You wanted to move money around. No, we didn't want to move capitalist money around. We want abolition. We want punishment gone. We want prisons gone. We want people to have their land. We want clean water. We want housing. We want security. We want to rethink what security means so that it doesn't mean policing, and it means keeping people safe in our hearts and homes and in real ways. So that's my last 30 seconds, I guess. But I just really think, and I do want us to maybe talk about this more in question period, that what are the strategies to fight this? It's something that's very, very frustrating to me right now. And I think for a lot of people that have been in this work and are on the front lines that are actually seeing a lot of our work be effectively dismantled right now, under this idea of, oh yeah, we're all taking you seriously when we're talking about policing. I'm like, but you're talking about body cameras and training people and giving them more funding. And you're talking about getting more Black officers. And you're not talking about actually addressing this violence and actually thinking about what it means. And what happens when we get bound up in that and think that, you know, Royal Bank can help us end policing at the same time as they fund a pipeline that is directly leading to Indigenous people being policed and criminalized. So I'll stop there. Sorry, I was trying to talk really fast to get it all in, but thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. That was just so powerful, and these really big questions that folks should really be thinking about, because it is much more complicated. It is much more connected in a lot of ways that that folks might not necessarily always be considering when they're having these conversations. So thank you very much, Elle. I'd just like to introduce our next speaker now, Dr. Pam Palmater, who is a Mi'kmaq lawyer, professor, author, and social justice activist from Eel River Bar First Nation. Her extensive writing focuses on Indigenous law, politics, and governance. Thank you for joining us, and I'm super excited to hear what you have to say.
Thanks so much, Kwe Nin Deluizi Pam Palmater. I'm coming to you from unceded Scugog territory, so we're all in different places. I'm so honored to be part of this incredibly amazing panel. I mean, Elle, I could listen to Elle for literally hours. Everything she was saying, I was like, yes, that's right. Remember that policing aren't just the officers driving around in cop cars, it's the state. The state polices us and our bodies and our communities and our even our cultures and identities. And, you know, the point that she made that, you know, this carding business continues. Everything about policing continues. We have had so many justice inquiries and investigations and oversight committees. And I mean, there's thousands of recommendations and many of them repeat themselves, but none of that, none of it has had an impact. None of it. So, you know, that there's that old saying around, if you know, you just keep doing the same thing because it's that status quo literally reinforcing and protecting itself. And they look at people who say, you know, defund the police or abolish police as something radical. We'll point to one thing that has worked. Everything is getting worse in so-called policing. And that includes everything that Elle has talked about. And I think we don't talk about that point enough, that everything that we've ever complained about the police continues, all of it. And it's increasing our incarceration, increasing brutality, increasing sexualized violence, you know, increasing the separation of families, all of it. And, you know, for Indigenous peoples, and we stand in solidarity with Black peoples too, and all peoples who are marginalized, this really needs to be attacked head on. And I also agree with Elle's comment around, you know, who gets to be an activist and who gets to say, and then how that gets portrayed. I mean, even activism can be corporatized. You know, even so-called activism can be co-opted by funders and politicians and MOUs and no end of stuff. So we've really got to get at the root of these strategies. And I'm glad that we'll talk about that in the questions and answers. Part of what I want to do, and, you know, to my mind, I feel like I'm a broken record, but, you know, every time we engage in different panels, there are always people that say, oh, I had no idea. Or, you know, we think that these are a few bad apples. Well, of course, you can point to any situation gone wrong. You know, the poor police, they have a dangerous job. But in reality, nothing is going wrong. This is exactly how police forces in this country and in the United States were set up. They were literally created under a white nationalist framework that was highly racialized and trained to respond to every situation with violence and suppression. So none of what's happening is actually outside of what they were designed to do. I mean, when you have RCMP officers rolling up in essentially tanks with IED devices and snipers, I mean, those are all acts of war. Those are all things that you see on the war, you know, on the war front. Those aren't the way you deal with citizens and people and communities and children. And so I want to talk a little bit about that in my time. And I'll just use the RCMP as an example, because there's a long history on Turtle Island of the RCMP, especially of taking a lead role really in the genocide, oppression and suppression of Indigenous peoples, you know, removing us from our lands clearly. But think about the role, the really integral role that the RCMP had in keeping us from our lands, keeping us trapped on reserves, not allowing us to leave, even though the RCMP themselves knew that it was a direct violation of our treaty rights. And they, there's correspondence that they knew that this was in violation of our treaties, but they enforced this non-existent law anyway, with, you know, extreme violence. They stole our kids and put them into residential schools. And when we tried to escape for the abuse and violence and torture that was there, they would be drugged back, kicking and screaming. Parents were imprisoned. If they didn't send our kids to, in some situations, were effectively torture schools. And they prevented us also by law and the enforcement of the law from even practicing our, you know, cultures and identities and ceremonies, but also in the way in which we were supposed to sustain ourselves in terms of hunting, fishing, gathering, and trade. And you know, some people would say, well, Pam, that's all historical. No, because who is the primary police force that prevents Indigenous peoples from still engaging in our traditional economies or in our constitutionally and treaty protected right to trade with one another? It's the RCMP. So the RCMP are very central with other policing agencies like Fisheries and Oceans, for example, to stop us from hunting and fishing and gathering and cutting down trees to build our houses and engaging in trade, engaging in tobacco, the growth and sale of tobacco, or even in gaming, which is also a traditional practice. And worse than that, you know, worse than just preventing us from being able to take care of ourselves is the way in which they collaborate with CSIS, with Indigenous Affairs, and with like all federal government and provincial government departments, and even private corporate agencies, the extractive industry, to all participate together in their surveillance, the monitoring, the invasion of our privacy, the tracking of our movements, who we talk to, who we don't talk to, the messages that we're sending. And none of that goes two ways. You will never see the RCMP working with Indigenous peoples to gather intelligence on Canadian mining companies, for example, or pipeline companies, which are the most violent and dangerous and human rights breaking in the world. None of that comes our way. So this is all very racialized, hyper-racialized, and focused on Indigenous peoples. And so this is, it shows a very clear bias. They were set up to be that way. They've continued to be that way, and it's changed. So instead of trapping us on reserves now, they monitor our movements so that we can't stop pipelines. We can't stop man camps. We can't stop mining. We can't stop anything that destroys our land or presents a risk to our people, or we will be incarcerated. But if we're impoverished because we can't take care of ourselves, then our poverty is essentially criminalized. You know, we're not allowed to be homeless on the street. We're not allowed to steal enough food to eat. You can't steal winter jackets for your children. All of these things. So we're not allowed to exist either way. We're not allowed to take care of ourselves. We're not allowed to not take care of ourselves. In every sense, our whole identity has been criminalized. And that's what policing is about. It was always meant to get us out of the way. And, you know, this isn't new. From the very first precursors of the RCMP with the Northwest Mounted Police, they were also involved in the exact same activities, including the sexualized violence and sexual extortion and trafficking of Indigenous women and little girls, which continues today. And that's part of the problem. When we focus on things like, say, just street checks, for example, we don't also see how that's very much tied to the trafficking and sexual exploitation of young Native girls who have run away from foster homes, for example. And it's not just the RCMP. So I don't mean to say that this is just the RCMP. I'm just using them as one example because there are many police forces, Toronto Police Force, the Winnipeg Police, Saskatchewan Police. I mean, the SQ in Quebec, especially, very lethal police forces for Indigenous and Black peoples. And it's not like we don't know this. So every time there's a round of protests or resistance or activism, people are like, oh my goodness, is there racism in Canada? Do you think there's a problem in policing? Maybe we should talk about that. We have had tons and tons and tons of justice inquiries. I mean, the Donald Marshall Inquiry in Nova Scotia, Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, Aboriginal Justice Inquiry of Manitoba, the Justice Inquiry in Saskatchewan, the Neil Stonechild Inquiry, Ipperwash Inquiry. I mean, it's endless that shows, you know, you've got this countless amount of evidence and legal review and research and statistics over and over and over again to say, yeah, we've got a problem in policing. It's very racist, it's very violent, and they don't actually protect Indigenous peoples. So you've got this like over-policing, which is very aggressive and targeted, and then you have no protection at all for Indigenous peoples. And that's a real problem. But the fact that all of these inquiries were very public, tons of media, some of these scenarios had movies, books written about them. And, you know, the one of the most recent ones, the Ipperwash Inquiry, said this is a myth about bad apples, that all of the Ontario Provincial Police, it's widespread racism. And, you know, I like I said, I feel like a broken record for bringing this up all the time, but the kind of racism we're talking about isn't, we got into fisticuffs, it got a little too violent, and by accident, I broke the guy's arm. No, it's when you have the premier of the province saying, get those effing Indians out of the park, peaceful Indians who happen to own the land, by the way. And then, you know, the head of the OPP saying, hey, let's amass an effing army. Let's get a real effing army and do this. Do these effers big time. Should it be any wonder that an OPP officer shot unarmed, peaceful land defender Dudley George? No, of course not. And that just takes us into the present. So it's not just these individual instances of what's happened, but look at all the RCMP class actions. So let's just look at the RCMP as an institution. You have the 2017 class action for female RCMP officers being sexually harassed, abused, and bullied by male police officers. You then have the 2019 class action, which is by all the other females that work at the RCMP, the civilians, for example, who are sexually harassed and bullied by the RCMP officers. Then you have class action suits by just RCMP in general for the culture of violence, harassment, bullying, intimidation. And that's within the RCMP. So imagine if the RCMP as an institution is racist and sexually violent and corrupt, then what chance do people like Black women or Indigenous people on the outside have when it comes to the RCMP? Because that's how powerful and insulated they are as an organization. There's been, you know, there might be a class settlement that we all pay for, by the way, but where is the retribution? Where is the consequences? Where is the accountability for all of these predators and other people that work in the RCMP and that have allowed it to continue? And so you've got other class actions from outside of the RCMP by murdered and missing, by Inuit in the North. You've got lots of other billion-dollar class action suits, and nothing has been done. So here's the thing about all of these reports and all of these class action suits around the RCMP. The Auditor General reviews, you know, some of this stuff and says, you know, there's a real problem in the RCMP because they're more concerned about all of these class actions and the money that they'll have to pay out than they are about actually addressing the perpetrators in the RCMP. So there's no interest. There's no intention to deal with it. And that's why we have to go beyond what we've suggested. There's no amount of cultural awareness training that's going to deal with the problems in the RCMP. And you know why? Because we're talking about widespread corruption. And I'm not just saying that as my political opinion. The RCMP did their own internal report on just a certain set, subset of things that could be corruption, like fraud, theft, interference with judicial processes, misuse of confidential information, perjury, falsifying and planting evidence. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of their officers have been found guilty of that. And then you have the, you know, the gall of the commissioner, doesn't matter which one, to stand up there and say, you know, I'm not really sure that there's any systemic racism or any problems in the RCMP. The APTN, the Aboriginal People's Television Network, just came out this week with yet another massive expose of RCMP Facebook groups, hundreds and hundreds of RCMP officers freely saying horrifically violent and racist things about Indigenous peoples. And that is something, this isn't new. I mean, the RCMP were informed about this years ago when the APTN did their first expose on this. So you've got a situation where we're not a few bad apples. It's widespread and they all insulate and protect themselves. And I know that I'm almost out of time, but I'm trying to make the point here that racism and violence against Indigenous peoples is literally so ingrained in the RCMP that they don't see it as a problem, nor does the state see it as a problem, because it achieves a very important ends. It continues to remove us from our lands, disconnect us from our economies, disconnect us from our identities. And with, and if you put it all together, like Elle says, you can't even just look at it like that. Put what police are doing to our people, over incarcerating us at astronomical rates, putting our kids in youth corrections, putting them in foster care, in group homes, putting our women in institutions. You know, at the end of the day, there won't be any Indigenous peoples left. And that has always been the ultimate objective. So I think when we move to talk about some of the strategies, we really need to talk about what are going to be the most effective strategies in terms of where we're putting our resources, how we're allying, and when to call each other out. So the corporatization of activism, I think that needs to be called out much more, because it literally counters the things that we're doing. So, you know, we're having a panel on defunding the police or defunding racism or abolition. Then you can have another Native group, you know, host a podcast with the head of the RCMP and say, oh no, everything's good. We have all these good relations. Just hire a few more Native people. And so we have to be able to confront that head on. So sorry if I went over a little bit, but like Elle, I was trying to speak faster than the 15 minutes that I had.
No, that was wonderful. And thank you so much again for sharing and really just breaking it down for folks that are watching it, and not only the historical context, but how that's prevalent and permeating different, you know, institutions even to this day. Because I think that's really important for people to realize that, you know, Canada does have systemic racism, and it's prevalent. So thank you so much. For folks that are joining us again, welcome to Policing Black and Indigenous Lives in Canada. Thank you for joining us. You know, next up on our amazing panel is Rekesh Walters. And I'm super excited to be introducing her. She is a writer, community advocate, and articling student who is dreaming up alternatives to policing and punishment. Thank you for joining us, Rekesh. Oh, I think you're on mute.
Can you hear me?
That's great.
Right, thanks so much for having me. So I'm speaking with you from so-called Toronto on Treaty 13. I honor and appreciate the Indigenous folks who have been resisting state violence on this land since first contact, the Mississaugas of the New Credit, the Anishinaabe, Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. I just want to start by thanking all of you for being here. I'm checking out the chat, and there's a lot of really interesting conversations going on, and the moderators are doing a lot of hard work to try to keep the conversation positive. So I appreciate all the engagement and discussion. And I just want to honor all the work and planning that went into making this project a reality. I'm no expert on policing or transformative justice, and I'm frankly pretty nervous to be sharing space with such incredible activists, writers, and theorists who I have admired and learned from for such a long time. I thank all the Black women who have loved on their families and communities before me and showed me how to as well. Like my mother, Judith, my grandmother, Lynette, and my Maroon ancestor, Nanny. I also thank my mentors and teachers like Elle Jones, Rachel Zellers, Rachel Herzing, Constance Backhouse, Joanne St. Louis, Nisa Cromwell, Heather Hoynes, Rebecca Blakey, Darren Jordan, Senator Kim Pate, Desmond Cole, Bill and Art, so many others. And it might seem strange that I'm naming all these names, but I'm sharing this with you because I'm wary of the professionalization of activism and the danger of building up certain folks up as the exceptional few with, you know, knowledge, while each of us is only really the product of the people and places that we've encountered. So in echoing Elle, she said, you know, all of us have a responsibility to be activists, and I encourage each and every one of us to not only take in the information of today, but also take responsibility for some of the challenges and ills that folks are bringing up today. So as mentioned, I'm a writer, community advocate, law graduate, and articling student who is dreaming and building alternatives to policing and punishment. I'm a survivor of sexual and physical violence, and I'm really interested in how communities can heal from interpersonal harm without placing already traumatized, impoverished, and marginalized people in cages. So I'll start by talking a bit about the status quo, but I'm hoping to spend most of my time discussing alternative paths forward. So first of all, the police do not keep us safe, as you've heard. We know that the racialization of crime has a long history in Canada and has consistently put Black and Indigenous people in Canada in danger. We know that in the 17th century, Black people who escaped slavery were framed as thieves and criminals in runaway slave advertisements. Self-liberated Black people were scrutinized and tracked by law enforcement for being criminal runaways. So Black people trying to get free was criminalized at the outset. And the association between Black people and criminal activity remains incredibly powerful. In Sinclair versus London City, which is a case that any of you folks can look up and read if you'd like, the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario accepted that the racialization of Black men contributes to societal stereotypes as Black men as more likely to be criminals and to act in physically violent ways. The tribunal accepted that these stereotypes may lead to increased surveillance and monitoring of Black men. We know this. Black women and children are often framed as angry, lazy, and dangerous by the state. In Desmond Cole's best-selling book, The Skin We're In, he discusses Peel Regional Police's treatment of a 6-year-old, 48-pound little Black girl. The police handcuffed her ankles and wrists together while she was at school. In March of this year, the Ontario Human Rights Commission confirmed what we all knew, that race was one of the reasons, if not the main reason, why police thought it was reasonable to place a child at school in handcuffs. The state does not even afford Black children the luxury of childhood, the luxury of being sheltered and protected from harm. Discrimination and racism against racialized individuals in Canada has been described by the Supreme Court of Canada as so indisputable that judges are able to simply take judicial notice of racism as a fact of Canadian life. Now, just this morning, in an article that Elle wrote, Fatuma and Abdul Abdi shared their notice to file a lawsuit against the province of Nova Scotia and the Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children. They shared their stories of childhood abuse and horrific, horrific trauma by the state, both while they were wards of the province and after they left child welfare, not child care. The harm they continue to experience is seemingly perpetual. Elle Jones shared Fatuma's story with the world in the Halifax Examiner with love and compassion, but I still felt like I was being ripped open this morning, reading Fatuma's account of her infant child being taken from her and later dying in care. I encourage each of us, actionable item, to take the time to read Fatuma's story today. Fatuma's account of her children being taken from her by the police at gunpoint, in the same way that she was also taken from her aunts as a child, should upend our belief that state actors make decisions in the best interests of Black children and Black families. So for this reason, although the police may conjure feelings of safety for certain Canadian residents, for others, policing is often the site of further violence and death. Cherished community members like Ijaz Chowdhury, Regis Korchinski-Paquette, Jason Collins, Aisha Hudson, DeAndre Campbell, Sean Thompson, Nicholas Gibbs, Orlando Brown, Pierre Coriolan, Abdurrahman Abdi, Andrew Loku, and many, many, many more. All of these folks were denied their lives after the police arrived on scene. For that reason, communities most affected by state violence are often less likely to call the police. Now, sometimes that means that interpersonal harm and violence continues unchecked, and that is a problem, which I'd like to talk about. But Black, Indigenous, disabled, the precious poor, sex workers are resourceful, and we find alternative ways to keep each other safe without calling the police. So I just want to talk about that for a moment. One of these ways is through transformative justice. Transformative justice is a political framework and ever-expanding set of strategies that help us to respond to violence, harm, and abuse without creating more violence, harm, and abuse by calling the police. So transformative justice, or sometimes I'll refer to it as TJ, is thought of as a way of making things right, or getting in right relation, or creating justice together. So transformative justice responses and interventions first, they do not rely on the state. For example, police, prisons, the criminal legal system, the foster care system, etc. They do not reinforce or perpetuate violence, such as oppressive norms or vigilantism. And third, they actively cultivate the things that we know prevent violence, like providing housing, providing a guaranteed livable income, providing healing, therapy, accountability, resilience, and safety for all folks involved, not just those who are the victims of violence, but also those who perpetuate violence. So in June, I wrote a piece for Rabble with one of my mentors, Rachel Zellers. And Rachel, if you're on the call, appreciate you, love you. This article is titled, "We Don't Need the Police, We Need Each Other." And in this piece, we articulate it is to not only have conversations about defunding or abolishing the police, but also interrogating ourselves and how each of us is creating a community, a world where we no longer need the police, where we make the police irrelevant. Transformative justice asks us to start by interrogating our own interpersonal and community relationships with questions like, okay, what tools do I need for myself or in my community to feel comfortable not calling the police when something goes wrong? Additionally, what are the conditions that I need to feel stable, self, safe, healthy? And how can I foster those same conditions for the people around me? What do survivors need? What do people who cause harm need? And what are some of the harmful ways we treat each other every day? And how do those actions help set the stage for violence and abuse to take place or to continue? And so what can I do to change those things? So ultimately, transformative justice requires us to step out of our busy, busy lives of individualism and capitalism and go, 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 to invest daily, weekly, monthly into cultivating safety and security for everybody around us. Transformative justice reminds us that the revolution starts at home, which is a great book I recommend. Okay, so what does transformative justice look like, Rekesh? Sounds perfect, sounds amazing, but I don't know how to do it. So one really inspiring example of transformative justice that I appreciate is this organization called Bear Clan Patrol. I work with Senator Kim Pate and folks from her office on a podcast called Appointed, a Canadian Senator Bringing Margins to Center. Shout out to that office and all the folks continuing the podcast like Regine. And in April 2020, I co-hosted an episode on transformative justice where we spoke with James Favell, which he's the co-founder of Bear Clan Patrol. So this organization, for those who don't know, is a community of volunteers that offer nonviolent, non-threatening, and non-judgmental support to those who need it through relationship building and reconciliation. Bear Clan Patrol goes out every night of the week with volunteers walking between 9 and 12 kilometers throughout their community. They hand out produce, snacks, and baked goods as they go. And all of these volunteers just try to intervene in situations of harm and neglect and offer care and whatever folks need. So it started in Winnipeg, and there are Bear Clan Patrols going out all over the country, including in Calgary and other cities. So I would recommend reaching out and finding out whether or not there's a Bear Clan that operates in your community. Perhaps you could start one. I think Bear Clan Patrol is an incredible example of shifting away from judgment and fear and towards care and compassion instead. I also want to name that, again, transformative justice is not easy. This work is not smooth. And although the organization is going through some shifts and challenges, their work remains vital. So another example, Black Lives Matter Edmonton. This is an organization that I've worked with for quite a long time. And this spring, myself and other advocates across the country petitioned our local governments to make our city safer for everyone, not just people who like the police. We drafted a letter to city council demanding that they divest from policing and invest in community, like many other cities across the country and across Turtle Island. Now, over 13,000 Edmonton residents sent similar letters to council, and we forced six full days of hearings where over 150 Edmonton residents expressed their views on the future of policing. Many, if not most of the presenters, expressed their concerns and discontent with the current state of policing and called for EPS to be defunded or abolished. Now, after hours and hours of listening to impassioned advocacy for community to defund and abolish the police and reimagine public safety, Edmonton City Council voted to cut EPS's budget by about 3%. And last week, EPS announced that they would be spending $500,000 on a brand new tank. So in response to our council's lack of action, Black Lives Matter Edmonton has decided to find ways to simply make police less relevant in our communities. in response to a question that Transformative Justice asks, which is, what tools and skills do we need to keep our community safe without state intervention? One answer that we came up with is the skills to de-escalate situations of conflict or violence when they arise. So we're currently rolling out de-escalation training, first internally and then for other interested community members, so that we can feel more confident resolving inter-community disputes without calling someone who may or may not have Black people's safety top of mind. So one last example, I know I'm out of time, but for folks who are interested in learning and reading more, please check out this organization. It's called Creative Interventions. It's used to be run by someone who I really admire named Rachel Herzing. And so what they did was compiled stories and examples of transformative justice and examples of people ending violence through collective community-based alternatives to state intervention. And they put it on a website. So you can find it. It's called the Storytelling and Organizing Project. And it's at www.stopviolenceeveryday.org. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Rekash, for, you know, delivering all of those powerful suggestions and teaching us about transformative change and different ways in which, I like how you said, communities can make police less relevant. And I think that was very powerful, so thank you. Up next, I'd like to introduce our last speaker, Meenakshi Mano, is the criminalization and policing campaigner at Pivot Legal Society. And I've had the opportunity to work with Meenakshi and absolutely, you know, am inspired by her work and everything that she's been doing with Pivot. And I'm very excited to have her with us today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, LaToya. And I again want to echo an appreciation for the work that you've put into today's panel, and I'm very honored to speak alongside Elle Jones and Dr. Pam Palmiter and Rekash Walters this afternoon. And I have great respect for the work that each of those speakers do. And it's really an honor to join them because I see them as leaders in the fight to defund police and beat back the colonial state that's known as Canada. I want to acknowledge that I'm joining this call from the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, so-called Vancouver, BC. And this is sovereign Indigenous territory, and settlers like myself must conduct ourselves with this at the forefront of all the actions that we take. Anyone who's listening, who's truly been listening to land defenders, already knows that while police and RCMP in particular, as Pam pointed out, as long as they exist to enforce colonial borders and industrial powers, and of course, settler colonialism, Indigenous resistance will continue to flourish. I also want to acknowledge that I'm joining from a community that's been ravaged by a drug poisoning crisis for the past 4 years. Though if you ask anyone who's actually been around, it's been at least six. As we fight to defund the police, we do so with the knowledge that we grieve thousands. People who have been killed by drug poisoning, murdered by drug policy, thrown away because of stigma and prohibition.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a panel by the BC Civil Liberties Association, called Policing Black and Indigenous Lives in Canada, a Digital Teach-In. One of the featured guests was Dr. Pam Palmiter, a podcaster and professor. To hear the rest of the panel discussion, head to YouTube and search for the channel Pam Palmiter. That's P-A-M space P-A-L-M-A-T-E-R. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Joel Somadal, Killian Davenport-Brown, Tess Pilkington, Pranjal Malik, Moy Shimori, Rima Raji, Michael Edelson, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593. Or you can email newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at CKUTMTL. Or connect with us on Facebook. Search for CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next.
This summer, I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website.